Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Happy Halloween. It's that time of the year again when we regale our children with tales of ghosts and goblins, dress them in ghoulish costumes, and take them about the neighborhood, trick-or-treating. And once again, Talking History turns to the ever-popular topic of the history of witches and witchcraft. This year, looking at the Salem witch trials with the author of a new book on the subject, Mary Beth Norton. And after that, in our commentary of the week, Ellen DuBois reports on a statement made to Congress by a group of historians on the prospect of a preemptive strike by the United States against Iraq. But before we get to those topics, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
Thank you, Brian. This week in history, on October 28, 1886, the Statue of Liberty was dedicated in a ceremony led by President Grover Cleveland. Known at the time as Liberty Enlightening the World, the 151-foot statue of a woman holding a torch was a gift from the French people to commemorate the Franco-American alliance during the American Revolution. Its sculptor was Frederic Bartholdi. Congress approved the site on New York's Bedloe's Island in February 1877, but Bartholdi did not finish the statue until May of 1884. It arrived in New York in June 1885, disassembled in more than 200 crates, and it took another year to erect it. By then, nearby Ellis Island had become the nation's leading port of entry for immigrants, and American poet Emma Lazarus was invited to write the now-famous lines that grace the statue's pedestal. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddling masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I'll lift my lamp beside the golden door. The Statue of Liberty, as it came to be known, was made a national monument in 1924, and Bedloe's Island renamed Liberty Island in 1956.
In addition to Halloween, this week also marks the end of daylight savings time, which has prompted us to report on just when we standardized our time in the first place. The measurement of time in the Western world began thousands of years ago in Mesopotamia, when the day was divided into 24 hours, the hour into 60 minutes, and each minute into 60 seconds. But because the day is determined by the rotation of the earth on its axis, time is quite local. Noon, for example, is when the sun is directly overhead at a particular location, which means that it differs by about 1 minute every 13.5 miles as one moves east or west. Now, this may not have been a problem for those who didn't travel more than a few miles, but it raised havoc with the railroads. They needed to create schedules that were accurate for the various locales through which they passed over their long-distance routes. The timetable convention, which became known as the Association of American Railroads, began studying the problem in 1872. 11 years later, it recommended that the British Royal Observatory in Greenwich, England, that served as a location for British Standard Time, become the starting point from which time zones would be created around the world, providing regular standard adjustments in time to match the movement of the sun. The changes were adopted in the United States in November 1883. Daylight savings time, by the way, was first adopted in the United States in 1918 during World War I to prolong the day and conserve energy. This is Talking History.
When Walter Ego was a little boy, no one to play with, so he invented toys. Diabolical playthings he would deploy. Mechanical parrots, the world they would destroy. They're swooping down upon their home, chewing into bits, leaving nothing but the bones. Where did they come from? Nobody knows. When will they leave here? Where will they go? They're swooping down on an unsuspecting town. Unknowing, the people gathered round. Their little claws were scratching at their eyes. All that they could hear was the evil parrot's cries.
Walter Ego and his flesh-eating parrots from hell.
Walter Ego and his flesh-eating parrots from hell.
From hell.
The Salem Witch Trials is one of the most enduring popular stories of the American past. Historians continue to study the trials, not only to better understand what happened, but also in hopes of drawing from them some lessons concerning human behavior. This week, Talking History's Eileen Dugan, professor of history at Creighton University, discusses the Salem Witch Trials with the author of a new book on the subject, Mary Beth Norton.
Of all the stories passed down to us from colonial America, that of Salem in the 1690s is easily among the most familiar. We tend to recall only the faintest outlines of the tale. Some girls began accusing a bunch of women of being witches, and then it snowballed. We remain intrigued by it. We can't help but ask ourselves, why did this begin? Why did such hysteria ensue? How could rational people actually believe others to be witches? And with a bit of nervousness, we inevitably wonder, what does this all reveal about us, about human nature? Well, with us today to examine this disturbing chapter in early American history is Dr. Mary Beth Norton, who is the Mary Donlan Alger Professor of American History at Cornell University. Dr. Norton is the author of In the Devil's Snare, The Salem Witchcraft Crisis of 1692. Welcome, Dr. Norton.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
What is the basic outline of what came to be known as the Salem Witchcraft Crisis?
Well, in early January or mid-January of 1692, two little girls who were living in the house of the Reverend Samuel Parris, who was the minister of Salem Village, which was an outlying area of Salem town, began to have mysterious fits. And the ministers tried to diagnose these fits, and finally a doctor was called in who declared that the girls were bewitched. From that point, several other young women became bewitched, and one thing led to another. They began to accuse certain people of bewitching them. That is until November of 1692, when the last formal charges were filed. And in that period, more than 140 people, both men and women, and some children for that matter, were accused of being witches. The accusations came throughout Essex County, not simply in Salem Village or Salem Town. And the trials then started in June of 1692 and continued up through May of 1693. So in total, the crisis lasted about 17 months.
What are the various interpretations that scholars have offered of this episode?
They have ranged widely. They have accused the girls of being hysterical. Some have said that the girls were, or likened them to juvenile delinquents and called them a girl gang. Some have said it's all a conspiracy of some families in the area against other families to steal their land. One of the most influential interpretations has been one that ties it to internal politics within Salem Village and people who were pro and anti Samuel Parris and pro and anti changes. Economic changes that were seen to be happening in the village. Most recently, it's been attributed to an encephalitis epidemic. It's also been attributed to ergotism, that is to poisoned rye, to in effect food poisoning that induced hallucinations in the accusers.
Was this the only community, Essex County, the only area that went through a witch craze at this time?
It's certainly the only one at this time. There were some accusations actually simultaneously in Connecticut, and I do talk about that, but it did not turn into a craze. The only other time that anything like this happened in New England was in 1662 in Hartford, Connecticut, but then there were only a maximum of 11 accusations. So that's really a very different order of magnitude altogether. There were some similar episodes in England and Scotland, however.
And it was what happened in Essex County similar to these other cases?
Well, yes and no. What made Essex County different, or one of the things that made Essex County different, was that the major accusers were young women who had these hysterical fits. Usually the accusers, as we know from Carol Carlson's work published in her book, The Devil in the Shape of a Woman, usually accusers tended to be young men in their 30s. And in the Salem crisis, the most important accusers were young women between the ages of 11 and 20 or 25, something like that. And a lot of them were servants. One of the other things that's different about the Salem crisis is that people of all descriptions and all ages were accused of being witches. Usually, in past episodes, the people accused of being witches had been older women who had quarrelsome relationships with their neighbors. At Salem, there were such women who were accused, but there were also many other people of many different descriptions, including some very prominent men, some children, some church members. It was a very different sort of crisis than we've ever seen before.
You've already mentioned some of the other interpretations that have been given to this phenomenon, but how do you explain what happened in Essex County?
Well, I posed the question to myself, why was Salem so different? And I went looking for answers in places that some other people had not looked. I had a couple of clues. One was that I knew that some of the accusers were refugees from the Maine Indian Wars, which were being fought at the time, and which nobody knows much about, and in fact I didn't know much about when I started the project. And I was very interested in the identity of these accusers, because although most books on Salem have focused on the accused, it occurred to me that it's the accusers who were the actors, and the accused were merely reacting. And so I thought it was important to spend more time looking at the accusers and who they were than other people had. So when I did that, I found that they had had very traumatic experiences in Maine during the Indian Wars. I was able to, in fact, place some of the accusers in particular incidents and particular contexts and to show certain things that have happened in their childhood and youth. I also went looking for letters that had been written by just anybody I could find in the 1690s that would mention the Salem crisis. And actually it was kind of disappointing at first because I didn't find that many references to Salem. I mean, I did find references, but they were very laconic. They'd just say things like, five witches convicted today or something like that. They wouldn't tell me what they thought about it. But the letters were full of information about the Indian Wars. And I realized that the Indian War was therefore on the top of everybody's head and that people were terrified by the threat that was posed by the Indians. And then that linked in my mind with the fact that Puritans, as we've long known, in fact, American settlers of all sorts, believed that Indians were devil worshippers and believed that their shamans were, in fact, witches before the arrival of Christians in America. And so, therefore, it became clear to me that what was going on in Essex County in 1692 was a link that the people were making between assaults in the visible world from the Indians and assaults in the invisible world from the witches. And that became crystal clear one of the things I did in the book is to construct, or while I was working on the book, I constructed a day-to-day calendar so I knew every day that everything happened. And it became clear to me then that the major beginning of the crisis as we understand it did not come in January, but came in mid-April after the accusation of the Reverend George Burroughs, who had been a previous minister of Salem Village, but who much more importantly, and what all other scholars on Salem have meant, basically spent the rest of his career on the Maine frontier as a minister in two of the communities that had been most badly hit by the Indians.
Who were the accusers in this episode, and who were the accused?
The accusers, as I've indicated, were young women. A number of them were refugees from Maine. They were servants who were living in Salem Village. Their entire lives had been destroyed by the Indian War. One of them, for example, was the granddaughter of a man who had been one of the wealthiest men in Maine, but she'd ended up as a servant in Salem Village because her entire family had essentially been wiped out. Another one had watched basically as her grandparents, all of her father's siblings and their families were killed, and her cousins were carried off into Indian captivity. She and her parents had somehow escaped, but basically everybody else in their family had been killed in the Indian Wars.
And you mentioned that many of these accusers were very young. And was it unusual? Wasn't it unusual for young children, even as young as 13, to be believed in court?
Yes, in fact, it was a rule in English law at the time that children under the age of 14 were dubious witnesses in a courtroom proceeding, that their testimony was not to be fully believed. But adults could testify for them. And so one of the arguments that I make in the book is that it's not simply the accusations of the young girls that makes a difference, but also the fact that they were supported by adults in their families of the young children. Now, of course, a number of the servants were older. They were in their late teens and early 20s, and they, of course, could speak for themselves.
Did any of the accusers have connections with the accused?
Oh, yes. In fact, the accusers who had spent time in what was then called Falmouth, and which is now called Portland, Maine, had, of course, been among the congregants who attended church services run by the Reverend George Burroughs. And one of the accusers, in fact, the accuser who I think is the most important of them all, Mercy Lewis, had actually been a servant in his household for a while. And we know that from her testimony against him at his trial. So I believe that the accusers knew some of the accused, especially George Burroughs, very well.
Why did people in this area, Andover in particular, come to believe that they were, from your title, in the devil's snare?
In Andover, a number of people confessed to being witches, and in fact, I should say here that more people were actually accused of being witches in Andover than in Salem Village or in Salem Town. More than 40 people in Andover confessed to being witches, and I think that they were, in effect, persuaded by the antics of the afflicted. We haven't really talked about this yet, but when someone would be examined by the magistrates, they would be examined in the presence of the afflicted accusers, and the afflicted accusers would fall down at the touch of the, or not fall down at the touch, but fall down at the glance of the accused, and would have very dramatic fits in the examination room. And many of the people who confessed to being witches later on said that even though they personally didn't really think they were witches, they were convinced by this that they had to be witches. And other people told them, you have to be a witch. See what happened when you looked at these people. And then their touch would revive the afflicted, and therefore they would be seen as that this was, they were, you know, revived by the touch of the witch. This was called the touch test. And they would be told by the magistrates, this means you're a witch. And so some of the people said, well, gosh, I guess I must be a witch, even though I didn't really know it. Then other people would, in fact, admit that they had done things like tried to do fortune telling or had done sort of counter magic, engaged in the occult in some way. And in the late 17th century, all of this was believed to be witchcraft.
What was one of the more interesting accusations that you found?
One of the accusations that other scholars have been unable to explain is the accusation of Captain John Alden. Captain John Alden was one of the most prominent merchants in the colony of Massachusetts. He was the son of John and Priscilla Alden, who people know about from the legend of Plymouth Colony. And I found that you actually can explain John Alden's accusation, because Alden, as I say, was a prominent merchant. He sailed to Maine frequently, and one of the accusers accused him of trading with the Indians. And no one else who'd worked on Salem had actually gone and tried to find out whether Alden was really trading with the Indians. I went to London, and I found a letter, an affidavit, that indicated that indeed Alden was trading with the Indians, that Alden was seen as a traitor in the Indian War, and therefore he could be also seen as a traitor in the war against the witches. But again, this links the invisible world with the visible world.
Americans have an enduring fascination with these witch trials, if only for a metaphor for public hysteria. I mean, when you think of the Crucible, for example, in the McCarthy era, why do you think we remain interested in this episode?
Well, it is extremely dramatic. There's no question about it. And it is indeed interpreted in so many different ways. I think that people do tend to see the Salem witch crisis through the lenses of their own time. Certainly Arthur Miller did that in the play The Crucible, which I saw recently, and it was fascinating to me to see, now that I know the records of the trial so well, it was fascinating for me to see how Miller had both taken the actual words from the trials and the examinations and used them, manipulated them in various ways to turn them into a statement against the McCarthy period, which, of course, was his major concern. So it strikes me that the Salem witch crisis is something that each period in American history can read through the interpretive lens that they want to put on it. In my case, one could argue that it's a multicultural lens, in which I'm arguing, in effect, that race relations, in this case the relation with Indians on the frontier of Maine, is absolutely crucial to understanding this great iconic event in American history.
And what relevance do you think the story has to our world today?
Well, I think it does tell us that the danger in demonizing our enemies. I think that it's a today, in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks in New York City, the story of the Salem witch crisis does have a certain resonance, because this is another time, that is, the 1692 in my narrative is a time in which Americans are deeply concerned about mysterious enemies who appear from nowhere, who seem to have sources of information that the authorities cannot figure out what they are, and they attack without warning and then disappear. And I think this resonates with all of us. Also, one of the things I discovered in my research is that the governor flat out lied and concealed his role in the crisis when he was reporting on matters to England. And it makes me certainly wonder about politicians today who lie about matters to the American public, or who try to conceal, try to have secrecy so that people don't know what's actually going on.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much. We have been talking with Dr. Mary Beth Norton, professor of history at Cornell University and author of In the Devil's Snare, The Salem Witchcraft Crisis of 1692. Back.
For our site of the week, we recommend to you the site of the Salem Witch Trials. Joey Skidmore returns to tell you about what you will see when you get there.
The events of the Salem Witch Trials occurred not only in Salem Town, but also in Salem Village, now known as Danvers, Massachusetts. So you have two places to visit, which fortunately are only a few miles apart. And there are dozens of historic sites to see, only a few of which we have time to mention here. There's the home of Jonathan Corwin in Salem Town, where in February 1692, Magistrates Corwin and John Hawthorne examined the first three women accused of practicing witchcraft. Now known as the Witch House, it is the only structure still standing in the town of Salem with direct ties to the witch trials. The Salem Witch Museum, only a short walk from the Corwin home, takes you back to 1692 with a dramatic history lesson telling the story of the witch trials using stage sets, life-size figures, and voice narration. On a more somber note, you can visit the Salem Witch Trials Memorial. Dedicated in 1992 on the 300th anniversary of the trials, this award-winning space, with stone markers for each of those found guilty and executed, creates a reflective environment evoking lessons of human rights and tolerance. And if you want to see actual historical records of the Salem Witch Trials, stop by the Peabody Essex Museum, where over 550 original documents have been gathered and preserved.
And as Joey noted, there are dozens of other historic sites to visit while in Salem, many of which have nothing to do with the Salem Witch Trials, but that are well worth visiting, like the House of Seven Gables, the Nathaniel Bowditch House, the New England Pirate Museum, the Pickering House, Pioneer Village, and the Salem Maritime National Historic Site. So plan ahead and allow plenty of time for your visit. This is Talking History. Ellen DuBois is a professor of history at UCLA. When President George Bush began to make the case for a preemptive strike against Iraq, she and a colleague, also a historian, prepared and circulated a petition among other historians which they presented to Congress. As she explains in this week's commentary, the petitioners urged the Congress to carry out its responsibility to debate and vote on any call for military action as provided for in the U.S. Constitution.
Most people assume that history lies safely in the past, But sometimes knowledge about the past is crucial to action in the present. The prospect of a preemptive unilateral war between the United States and Iraq has made for just such a moment. This past August, as President George W. Bush began to accelerate his push for war, I and my colleague in the History Department at UCLA, Joyce Appleby, decided to do something that was both old-fashioned and newfangled: circulate a petition on the Internet and then travel to Washington to present it to the United States Congress. This is what our petition said. We, the undersigned American historians, urge our members of Congress to assume their constitutional responsibility to debate and vote on whether or not to declare war on Iraq. We ask our senators and representatives to do this because Congress has not asserted its authority to declare war for over half a century, leaving the president solely in control of war powers to the detriment of our democracy and in clear violation of the Constitution. I did not think that if the president was as determined to go to war as he seemed to be, our efforts would be able to stop him. But I did think that it was important to reassert that the Constitution places responsibility for this most solemn of decisions not with one man who commands the armed forces, but with a body of people obligated, at least theoretically, to represent their various constituencies. We began with the names of professional colleagues on our own email lists, and these people sent the petition on and so on. Names came in very quickly. Eventually, we collected 1,300 names of historians of colonial America and the United States. They came from every state in the Union. We asked more of our signers than the mere use of their names. Many helped us to make contacts with Congress people, to gain publicity for our cause, to give interviews to local newspapers, and to present the petition to a congressional delegation on September 17th. What we did was, I think, different than the numerous petitions that circulate on the Internet and go who knows where. We took our petition to Washington, D.C. and presented it there, just as citizens have been doing for over 200 years. It will be entered into the congressional record. Whether we will have made any difference in the outcome of the debate over or conduct of a war with Iraq, time and historians other than us will tell. But I do know that we made a small yet significant contribution to reviving our national political culture.
You've been listening to Ellen Du Bois, professor of history at UCLA. Joyce Appleby, also at UCLA, published an op-ed on the petition in the Los Angeles Times on September 17, 2002. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. As always, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions for future programs, either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information about the OAH and Talking History is available at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau, and happy Halloween.
Lost a bedroom where the vampires feast. The ghouls all came from their humble abode to get a jolt from my electrode.
They did the
monster mash.